Katsa will know how to use the cracks, how to use the carte blanche that give them to connect with Hamas. And more than that, just in the last Davos gathering, Prime Minister of Qatar says about the Houthis that they are a viable actor that we need to consider. And this is the Qatari way. The Taliban entered the room because Qatar said we need to talk with everybody. And the Houthis didn't enter the room because we need to talk with everybody. And the same way go to Hamas and Hezbollah. Because Qatar uses mediation to legitimize and whitelash terror movements under the false pretenses that they promised Trump that eventually business ties will reform it from the inside.
Lav, it's great to see you.
You too.
And I guess we're still waiting, like everybody else in the region, to see what happens with Iran. And every day we hear about more preparations and more preparations and a little bit more preparations and a little bit more preparations. Everybody's very prepared.
Yeah, well, certainly lacking the element of surprise at this point. But you may be reassured to know that Ambassador Mike Huckabee was very calm in his interview, which he gave to Israel's Channel 12 over the weekend. He basically made it sound like it's not happening anytime soon and that the Trump administration actually wants to give talks a chance. I'm skeptical about that, but sure, give it a chance and then attack Iran.
I heard somebody say that Iran has never won a war and never lost a negotiation.
Well,
so that's the case this time.
They're up against Mr. Art of the Deal.
So those are the latest reports, right? We're hearing of Special Envoy Witkoff was going to be in Israel, I think tomorrow, is potentially meeting with the Iranian foreign minister, and the Turks are trying to create a channel between Trump and the president of Iran. So it looks like negotiations are back on the table.
But meanwhile, the head of IDF intelligence was in Washington last week, and then over the weekend, the IDF chief of staff himself was in Washington over the weekend. So there's a lot going on there.
It partly, I think, has to do with the different timelines or different clocks, right? President Trump, I don't know if who very few people actually know what his calculations are, but there's this clock of the entrance of the U.S. forces into the region. There's this desire to allow negotiations over the nuclear program, however long that might take, and Trump has said that he's given them a deadline. Israel has a separate clock because Israel also sees the ballistic missiles as an existential threat, Iran's ability to rebuild its ballistic missile program. And connected to that is Iran's attempts to rebuild its air defenses. And every day that goes by, Iran has the ability, and in fact, it's working very hard, to rebuild its air defenses, which would make it much harder for Israel to operate in Iranian skies and to begin rebuilding its ballistic missile program, which is complicated. They have to bring in advanced equipment and mixers. It's not so simple. But that's one deadline that's also ticking from an Israeli perspective.
I would dispute the fact that Iran's air defenses make it harder for Israel to act, because as we've seen, that seems to be no impediment. Israel seems to be pretty good at taking out those air defenses. But yes, I suppose it would be easier if they weren't there. There's also the fact that we don't know what Iran's going to do, right? Like, Iran can attack Israel at any point. And so people ask me, I imagine you get this too, as like an expert, like, so random people, friends, people in shul will come up to me and ask me when I think it's going to happen. And I'm just like, everyone needs to calm down. It's not happening right now. And like, too many people are living their lives as if like it's going to happen right now. And I just don't think I don't have like some source in the White House telling me this, but especially with these talks happening now, like, I think we can be calm for a few days. If by the time this podcast comes out, it turns out I'm wrong, then I'll feel very bad about it. But I think we're pretty safe.
And I mean, there are definitely preparations being made in Israel for the possibility of an Iranian strike. But I agree with you. I think that President Trump will certainly give time for these negotiations to take place. I do think, though, that something that we've argued in the Miskov Institute is that, as you said, the underlying reasons for, and something that we've discussed, the underlying reasons for the protests in Iran don't have any solutions. The economic reasons, the mismanagement, the corruption, the desire for greater freedoms. And so whether or not we see an attack in the next few weeks, and whether or not that attack really does destabilize the regime or doesn't, we are likely to see the Iranian people, I think, whether it's in a week from now or a month from now or 3 months from now, but the continuing protests and tensions with the regime.
well, they deserve freedom. They deserve a better leadership. And I think for the past, I guess it's 27 years now, since 1999, I believe, they've had major protests every couple of years. And these are the, I think the ones earlier this year or that started at the very end of December were the biggest ones ever, I believe. But they want that freedom and they've made it clear for a very long time. And we just have to hope that something can be done to help them get it.
And we've at the Misguided Institute continued to also advise decision makers that, as you said, the Iranian people deserve their freedom. A moderate, peaceful Iran would be a tremendous boon for the region, and that both the U.S. and Israel should do what they can to help create the conditions for the Iranian people to create. Obviously, only the Iranian people can create that better future for themselves. But the U.S. and Israel, to a degree, can help create the conditions which enable them to shape that better future.
And if they want to have relations with Israel one day, you know, there's a plot of land in Tel Aviv waiting for their embassy. Do you know about this?
No.
Okay, there's in like North Tel Aviv, like the old north of Tel Aviv, there's a playground. It's on a plot of land that Iran bought, I think, like in 1978, like right before the revolution, to build an embassy in Tel Aviv. And legally, Israel can't like confiscate that land. Like they can't use it. They can't sell it to develop or lease it to developers to build something there or anything. So it's just a playground. And it'll be a playground until Iran decides to claim it one day.
I don't know about the kids who like the playground, but I hope we see that. We see that soon.
Yeah.
Going from Iran's economic challenges to really Israel's remarkable economic resilience, Startup Nation Central released recently its report on the Israeli startup ecosystem in 2025. And the numbers are really remarkable, especially given that we're coming out of a year of difficult war. Israel, the total private investment into Israel's startup ecosystem in 2025 was $16.7 billion. That's a rise of 32%. From the previous year, from 2024, the total value of mergers and acquisitions in the Israeli ecosystem was $82.3 billion. Something that's interesting is over the last number of years, even before October 7th, there was a lot of conversation about how do we move from a startup nation to a scale-up nation. And that's indeed something that we are seeing that the numbers reflect. So, for example, there was a growth of 84% in B rounds and later funding rounds for Israeli startups. And a lot of the rounds themselves were significantly larger, reflecting the fact that investors, both in Israel and from abroad, are investing in larger, more mature companies. We're seeing the, as always, cybersecurity and business software and AI are leading the pack. We've seen some very interesting developments. We talked with Yitz Applebaum on the previous episode about defense tech, some very interesting developments in space tech. There are a couple of signs of concern. We are seeing, I think, a decrease in fields like ag tech and climate tech and health tech. And we've also seen a little bit of a drop in the number of new companies being formed. But overall, if Israel set a goal for itself, being just not a startup nation, but scaling up and building really big, influential companies, it's been remarkably successful despite the war, and perhaps even in a sense because of it.
So I think a lot of the like very big and impressive numbers are because of like a few really, really huge mega purchases. And from what I'm hearing is like the smaller companies, the medium companies are maybe not doing as amazingly, and that there is a certain amount of movement of companies from Israel to be based in the U.S. For a variety of reasons. So the macro numbers are really good, but I think like when you zoom in and when you talk to people in the tech ecosystem, they are worried about those trends.
And there are things that Israel can do from a regulatory perspective, from a legal perspective, that can make it more easier or more attractive for these Israeli founders to stay in Israel for longer periods of time. And that's also something that, you know, definitely should happen. And Lev, we were both at last week at a very interesting conference, the Generation Truth Conference on Combating Antisemitism, that was organized by the Minister for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Antisemitism, Amichai Shikli. What were your thoughts about that conference?
It's a big question. I think Shikli views this conference as a way to invite various politicians mostly from Europe, but also some from South America, who he views as like-minded, and they oppose anti-Semitism. So they'll get up and they'll give a speech about how they oppose anti-Semitism and how like Israel is the vanguard against, you know, radical Islam, etc. And it's not a bad thing, but I come to this and I'm like, well, what are we accomplishing here? Because like the foreign ministry is there to bolster our relations with these countries. Like how is this conference actually helping us fight anti-Semitism? So that was sort of one of my big takeaways.
I think, you know, Amichai Shikli, he very much believes that the way to combat anti-Semitism and to strengthen Israel's position in the world is to ally Israel with these right-wing conservative movements in Europe and around the world that are opposed usually to Muslim, unchecked Muslim immigration to these countries, to woke policies or, you know, progressive policies. And traditionally, that's different than what Israel's traditional position. Israel's traditional position had been to distance themselves from these parties, often because some of them had Nazi roots. I was speaking to a member of parliament from Belgium who had come to the conference, and he said, it's true, our party 50 years ago had Nazi roots, but we've evolved, we've changed. And I was speaking to somebody else who's close to the Vox party in Spain. And they were arguing that there's a lot of differences between right-wing parties in Europe. Some may truly be anti-Semitic, and many just want to have responsible immigration policies. And it's not right to lump them all together. And I think that's been an evolution in Israel's approach over the last several years, especially due to the animosity of many of the parties on the left in Europe. And I think that Shikli's approach has a lot of merit to widening the circle of allies in Israel.
I'm not opposed. And I think that contrary to the criticism that a lot of people say about Shikli, I think he is, or at least tries to be, careful about who he engages with, right? Like, it wasn't like the AfD, the alternative for Deutschland, the extreme right in Germany, was invited, because they have not officially denounced their Nazi past. And same with the Austrian Freedom Party, where when they had they had like a big corruption scandal and a fall from grace. But before that, when they were powerful in the government some 10 odd years ago, there were people in Likud who really wanted to engage them, but the state of Israel never officially engage them, and so they weren't invited either, for the same reasons that they never like apologized or distanced themselves from their Nazi past. But he's the diaspora minister and the minister for fighting anti-Semitism, and that should be about helping the Jews where they want help. And to like, there used to be somebody who, he's currently Israel's ambassador to Singapore, but he used to be in charge of the Likud party's foreign relations. His name is Ali Khazan. And he used to do what Shikli is doing as an employer of Likud, to build connections between Likud and other right-wing parties in Europe with great success. And I just like feel like, I don't know, like that's not the job description for Shikli. It's not that what he's doing is bad. I just think like, a conference on fighting anti-Semitism should be focused on Jews.
I agree. By the way, my favorite speaker was Gad Saad.
A Jew.
I thought he's just brilliant and sweet and Jew. I mean, very disturbing to hear his description of his own experiences. Yeah. Well, both in Canada, but also in Hebrew University, which apparently wasn't willing to invite him.
We should tell people, right? Like Gad Saad, for those who aren't familiar, he rose to prominence as like an anti-woke kind of author, but he is an academic. He has an academic career, but he, until he was, I think, like a young teenager, grew up in Lebanon, and then his family moved to Canada. And he says that Canada now is worse than Lebanon in the 70s and 80s, which is shocking. I mean, things are bad in Canada, but that's shocking.
But what's also shocking is he was talking to some people about arranging a lecture at Hebrew University, because he's considered a leading scholar on evolutionary psychology and consumer psychology. And he ran into a lot of opposition because the people at Hebrew University, which, by the way, gets a lot of direct funding from the Israeli government, thought that he was too controversial, which in a sense shows the sorry state of some Israeli universities.
But meanwhile, he did a lecture, like basically a public lecture in Tel Aviv, hosted by the Tel Aviv International Salon, which is a very good an organization that does a lot of these like public events. And the moderator was our fellow Misgav fellow, Fleur Hassan Nachum. And there were thousands and thousands of people there. So obviously he has hit a nerve with Israelis, and I think, you know, I'm a fan. I admit that I've not read his books, but I'm a fan of his online work. Mm-hmm.
No, and I do agree that what's often missing after we talked to Arsene last week about the Bondi Beach attack, and every time there's an event and you have all these condemnations, but the question always is, what should be done? What are the actual best practices that effectively change minds, that effectively make Jewish communities more secure, that effectively deter anti-Semites, that effectively strike the right balance between free speech and countering incitement? And I agree that that is what's missing, is really policy-focused work. It sounds like a job for Miskav, but really policy-focused work on what are the best practices in combating the surge of anti-Semitism that we're seeing.
Yeah, and so there was an interesting speech also. I agree with you, but I think my favorite speech was also Gadsad. But there was a speech by Yoram Chazoni, who's essentially the head of the National Conservatism Organization, ideological movement in the U.S., even though he really lives in Israel. And he gave a speech basically saying that the reason Tucker Carlson, or the reason the national conservatives, right, which he says are the plurality of Republicans, the other people are not so sure, but his argument is that they are, and the reason that they haven't rejected like Tucker Carlson is that the Jewish community has not properly presented the case that Tucker Carlson is an anti-Semite. And he was like, where is the 15-minute video explaining, which I listened to that and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, there's videos all over the place and articles and everywhere. The Free Press, I've read from the Free Press, the National Review, the New York Times, like, take it left, right, center. Like, everyone's been talking about this for, I don't know, I feel like since the Iran war last year, maybe even
before.
I'm
trying to find a way to get my Twitter, my X feed to be less videos of Tucker Carlson being anti-Semitic.
I know,
it's
right?
Really boring.
Same with Candace Owens. I think that there were things in his speech that I thought were interesting. I think it's true that like the American Jewish establishment does not know how to talk to these people and that they should be trying to find better way to build bridges with them. But I think that he also is either in a bubble or is just not willing to engage with what's actually happening out there. So I wanted to talk about actually something that I wrote a couple hours before we recorded this, an article about this new app called Upscrolled. It's a new social media app that came out like a few months ago, but as of this week, it was number one on Apple's App Store. And I believe as of today, 2.5 million people have joined it. And it's a lot of TikTok refugees. Why are people leaving TikTok? Because, you know, there was a law passed already during the Biden administration that said that China cannot majority own a social media operating in the U.S. So TikTok sort of spun off its U.S. operations and it was sold to a group of U.S. investors led by Larry Ellison of Oracle, and Michael Dell is also there. And now you have all these anti-Israel influencer types who say move to Upscrolled because TikTok is now being controlled by the Jews, basically. They're usually smart enough not to say it like that, but that's what they are basically saying. And the creator of Upscrolled, his name is Isam Hijazi. He was born in Jordan and he's an Australian citizen, but he identifies as Palestinian. And he spoke at a conference in Qatar this week. There was a Web Summit Qatar, which is this annual tech sort of conference also led by someone who's extremely anti-Israel, Patty Cosgrave. Anyway, he was talking about Larry Ellison and Michael Dell, and he goes, they've been controlling the media as in the TV outlets, and now they understand social media is the new way to get information out, so they want to control the narrative again. And to me, I was like, is this the Protocols of the Elders of Zion? Like, he's just up there on a stage talking about Jews controlling the media. And he said later, like, his company doesn't need to take Zionist money to succeed. And the moderator was Greg Karlstrom, who's a journalist from The Economist, someone who I have a lot of disagreements with, but I think is at least tries to be a fair-minded person. And there he is on stage in Qatar with a guy who's saying, like, clearly anti-Semitic things. And he's like, well, do you have any evidence of that? Like, trying to push back in a way that also, I guess, won't offend his Qatari hosts. I was like, I do not envy this guy.
And Qatar is really in the center of a lot of what's happening, both within the Board of Peace and the question about the next stage of Gaza, the question of potential U.S. action in the region, military action in the region, and of course, their influence in the United States in Europe, in the region. So that's a great segue, I think, to our guest, Dr. Ariel Admoni, one of the leading experts on Qatar. We'll really go down deep into what Qatar, how Qatar acts, what it wants, how it creates its image. But before that...
This is the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute for National Security and a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security and resilience, its regional cooperation and integration, and its international standing and alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise and go beyond the shallow discourse to bring you fresh insights into the most important events and developments on the Israeli and Middle East agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date. And you can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read your comments and suggestions. We really appreciate them, so keep them coming. This week's guest is Dr. Ariel Admoni. Dr. Admoni is a senior research fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security and one of the leading experts on Qatar. Both his PhD and his many academic papers and research articles focus on all aspects of Qatari domestic policy, foreign policy, the role of religion in Qatar's actions and behaviors, its relations with the West, with the broader Middle East. Dr. Almoni is a sought-after lecturer and expert, frequently lecturing at high-level diplomatic, governmental, and military forums. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Ariel Admoni. Dr. Ariel Admoni, it's great to have you on the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast, and especially at this moment of tension in the region when everybody's wondering what comes next. But before we dive into Qatar and Iran and Israel, I want to take a step back and maybe you could describe to our listeners, what is the connection between Qatar and the Muslim Brotherhood?
You start with a big one. First, thanks for having me. The connection between Qatar and Brotherhood is often described in a way that there is a distinction between scholars. Some scholars describe this relationship as patron-client relationship, and some describe it as merely political or geopolitical way. And I think that most accurate thing is to put it in the middle, because there are reliance by the Brotherhood on Qatari funding, on Qatari legitimacy, but at the same time, Qatar knows vis-a-vis the Brotherhood, not vis-a-vis Hamas, because there is a distinction in Qatari eyes, to use the Brotherhood as a client that I need to foster and even support. But when it becomes too hard, when it becomes too controversial, I need to know how to downplay the relationship. We saw it, for an example, by the fact that the International Union Muslim Scholars, the body of the Muslim Brotherhood in Qatar, is not an official body. Even Qaradawi was not an official capacity in the state. And there are some arguments or disagreements between the Brotherhood and Qaradawi, for an example, when Qatar tried to host... a decade ago, or even a decade and a half, international interfaith dialogue that Qaradawi refused because there were also rabbis. And in the same way, in 2014, we saw a case that Qatar expelled some Brotherhood figures from the state. But at the same time, the funding of Brotherhood operations outside the state, not inside the state, is continue and even under, let's say, just became bigger and bigger. And for that reason, we need to remember that Qatar see them as an asset, but at the same time, Qatar know how to preserve its balancing act regarding the brotherhood.
But is it just plausible deniability, like they're just keeping their distance so that they, when they need to, they can say we're not them? Or are they like true believers?
It's hard to see them true believers.
The royal family, that
it's hard to see them true believers because, for an example, the state mosque is named after Muhammad ibn al-Wahhab, that from the Wahhabiyya, that Wahhabism is actually contradicting with the brotherhood because the brotherhood against hereditary ruling, unlike the Wahhabism. In a similar manner, we need to remember that in the eyes of the brotherhood, the, let's say, heavy cooperation between France and Qatar, the US and Qatar, Britain and Qatar, is not perceived as a positive outcome. For that reason, I think that it's a cynical relationship that for Qatar, most of the time is beneficial. But it's not say that Qatar will against the flourish of brotherhood. It's just saying that Qatar need to balance it in order to preserve both sides. It's an interesting question if in the moment of truth revealed itself, what will Qatar decide? But I think that Qatar will try to preserve this balancing act, even when Trump announced about its decree about the brotherhood. We saw kind of dynamic that Qatar tried to preserve some branches. Qatar tried to exert an influence inside the Trump administration to try to convince to Trump to focus on Lebanon and Egypt, actually places that Qatar have more have a stronger cooperation with other factions, less the brotherhood. For that reason, I say an equation of 30-70. 70% is geopolitical, but there is 30% that Qatar will try to preserve this kind of dynamic with the brotherhood.
Ariel, you're considered one of the experts on Qatar, and you've been studying Qatar for many years. What got you interested in focusing so much on this, you know, relatively small state of 300,000-400,000 citizens, obviously with the third largest natural gas exporter in the world? What got you so interested in Qatar at the outset?
I just gave the great reasons to be interested in Qatar. No, I think that what's interesting, that if I return to love question, when you try to examine Qatar from inside and outside, try to examine the questions of religions, of conservatism, just give an example. 2 days ago, there was the Qatari Emir sister, Sheikha Mayasa, was interviewed to Financial Times in a puffis, we can say it for sure. And the headline was, "We are a very conservative state." And the example that Mayasa gave, Mayasa, by the way, is, was one of the supporters of Mamdani in New York, but the example of Sheikha Mayasa was, "We go to mosque every Friday." Now, it sounds nice, but as a religious guy in Judaism know, just attend the synagogue is not enough. And for that reason, when you try to understand the Qatari conundrum in order to examine it in aspects of sport, of terror, of cultural exchanges and activities, you have a very, you have a variety of information, of sources, a lot of information that you need to sift through sand and try to establish. And Qatar is very challenging. You need to constantly to think what will be the outcome or what will be the narrative that Qatar will try to spin from a current event. And this is why it's a very interesting and very troubling state.
So there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about Qatari influence around the world. What do you think is the biggest way that Qatar sort of spreads its influence, mostly Muslim Brotherhood or just sort of radical Muslim kind of messaging. Do you think it's Al Jazeera or do you see it in other areas?
I think there, when we examine Qatar, we need to remember that one foot came after the another. I give an example right now. There is a mini storm, may I say, about Georgia, in Qatar influence in the state of Georgia in the US, because there is a school curriculum that's Qatar influence and even try to appoint teachers that, or officials that appoint teachers. And there is an example a decade ago when Qatar Airways actually funded an event for children in school. In initiatives with education above all, Qatari fund that headed by Qatari Emir Mader. And there was an event that children from Atlanta study under Qatari supervisement, may I say, in official, in a, let's say, a way that, let's say, a strong, try to preserve and even try to develop cultural relationship. And it's the Qatar Airways headed these initiatives because a day after Qatar Airways opened their branch in Georgia. Because in Qatar, one example will lead to another. We can see that a cultural exchange will, most of the times, education above all, will be connected to support of Hamas or education initiatives. And later on, we can see in Syria how a humanitarian effort is connected to the business front. And for that reason, it's hard, it's not just hard to determine a specific way, because we can see, you mentioned Al Jazeera for an example. Al Jazeera in the last half of, in the last year is in intensive talk with Google about develop Core. Core, it's a AI model that will be relied on Al Jazeera news, among other things. And for that reason, Qatar knew or still knows how to connect media and their flight operations or education, humanitarian efforts. And for that reason, it's very large scale and very confusing when you try to determine just one foot or another.
I have to say, it's frankly impressive the way that Qatar is leveraging its immense wealth and sort of planning ahead, clearly is mapping out the concentric circles of influence around key figures or potential key figures or future key figures in order to reach them, you know, before they enter into positions of influence and then to influence them when they reach that. It's quite a sophisticated operation. When I've raised the issue of Al Jazeera with some senior people connected to the US government, the response that I've gotten at times is, well, Al Jazeera is an independent news organization. We believe in freedom of the press. So we can't ask the Qatari government or the Qatari royal family to intervene with Al Jazeera. To what degree do you think that is an accurate description? Al Jazeera is really independent, or is it really a mouthpiece of the Qatari government?
The board of directors of Al Jazeera is under Hamed bin Thamer Athani, and the head of the International Media Office of Qatar is under the supervisement and under the head of Thamer bin Hamed bin Al-Thani. And for that reason, there is very strong connection. Actually, just 2 months or 4 months ago, Al Jazeera replaced its management, and it became even more close to Qatari Foreign Office. And for that reason, we saw our officials that were laid before ambassadors, I think, to Germany, right now is under official capacity in Al Jazeera. And there was actually an opening for the U.S. to use this as a leverage, because as you mentioned, the official stance of the Qatari government was its freedom of speech, even when the US was anger and Israel was anger because the fact that the anti-Semitic views was vocal in Al Jazeera, this is was the explanation. And I think we can say, may even call it a green light by the US administration, when we don't respond to this kind of replace of management and see it as an opportunity. We saw that with in Qatar, with the food came the appetite, because since then, the stance regarding Trump just became even more radical. For an example, the operation versus Maduro was portrayed not just by Al Jazeera, but also by Al Arabi Al Jadid and Middle East Eye. Trump was portrayed as a shark with blood on his teeth that invade. And for that reason, when you rely on these excuses and give Qatar attitude that it's enough, just talking, and in the end of the line, you're gonna be with me, Qatar will just became more and more aggressive.
Do you think that if Qatar was a Russian or a Chinese entity, it would be forced to register as a foreign agent in the United States?
It's interesting, but I think that, as you mentioned before, when try to examine the Qatari influence in the U.S., you need to go back to a very, very, may say, Hayulik stage, when just it was Qaradawi in the University of Ohio by the Qatari emir father, not the current one, in 1995. And I think that right now, the awareness in the U.S. is just not enough, because right now it's too massive, and try to confront this, we need to go and say right now it's a problem to talk with Qatar. I don't think there is a consensus, sadly, about it in the US, but hypothetically, if there was a situation like that, we need to do a overhaul in education, Department of Education, in many, many universities, in K-12 institutions, in commercial business. And for that reason, I think that this kind of hope right now, it's not realistic, because Qatar is so invested inside, and right now it seems too much to ask for a registration of our agent. And I say more than that, I think it's useless, because we saw that Qatar don't need, there are sometimes they far off, but they don't need it, because we see an inflation in influencers, and we saw media outlets that actually work with Qatar, even though they're not registered under FARA.
Like Tucker Carlson, for example.
Came to mind.
Yeah.
Actually, he built a house, so you know.
Oh, wait, he bought a house there. Yeah, this week he was in Saudi talking about how great he felt as a Christian in Saudi Arabia, a country where there are no churches and you're not allowed to build any churches.
You could probably afford a house in Saudi Arabia as well. I mean, we could have, you know, you should have one in Israel. You could have one in Herzliya and in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, you know, and just make the rounds.
Yeah, he doesn't, I don't think he'd like it here very much.
Going to be strong competition with to fight with the Qatari money. Someone need to attract some budget for that.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit more about Qatari influence. You mentioned both universities and in K through 12. How do you think that the Qatari sort of royal family views all of this? Like, what is their plan? What is their aim here? And then what exactly are they trying to influence American institutions to do, or the students to do?
So it's interesting, because most of the cases that we examine the Qatari influence in the US universities, Actually, they tried to do so also in China and Russia. It wasn't effective because Qatar and Russia and China know to deal with. Anyway, in the US, I think that the connection was more subtle, because even the demonstration, it wasn't just that in Doha you push a button and then in Georgetown there they began the demonstration. I think it was more subtle in a way that Qatar relied on the Green Red Alliance in a manner that they culture and supported progressive thought. For an example, we saw how Doha News portrayed October 7th as a liberation moment, and we saw a week ago, Georgetown University in Qatar hosted an event about black music in Washington. And the headline of this gathering was Voices of Resistance, kind of thing. And Qatar used this discourse in a way that seems harmless, because it's just an academic discussion. Qatar knew what is very important for them. For an example, in Texas, we saw when they invested in Texas A&M, they want the copyright for nuclear research, because this is hard substance that I want in my house. But when it came to influence, I think that the thinking is about the next generation, about the historian that will write the book and the article about Qatar. Because right now, if you a scholar that just do his first steps in the academia, you know that grants mostly we enjoy some Qatari cooperation and don't anger the boss. There are journals that it's better not to target Qatar. Actually, I have a paper that I wrote about Qatar and the Muslim Brotherhood, and I sent it, never mind what was the name of the journal, and the answer was Muslim Brotherhood is not connected to terror. This is, and now I will admit, it wasn't the best article, but still, Muslim Brotherhood not connect to terror. And for that reason, I think the influence of Qatar is more subtle. And for that reason, it's more difficult to counter it. Because as Asher mentioned about Al Jazeera, what do I want from them? It's legitimate. It seems reasonable. It's free speech. It's a discourse that talk about, for an example, Qatar try to present itself as the champions of the global south. And we're talking about a state that is heavy cooperation with the industrial force of the world. And for that reason, Qatar tried to use this leverage, to use this discourse for its own good.
One of the biggest questions that were the biggest points of debate over the last 2.5 years has been Qatar's relationship with Hamas, where Qatar has repeatedly told Israeli journalists, foreign journalists, our support to Gaza was at the request of the Israelis, and it went through Israel, and it only went to people who were vetted by Israel. And the fact that we're hosting Hamas in Doha is only at the request of the West or of the US so that we can have conversations. We're not Hamas supporters. Here at the Miskav Institute, Mayor Ben Shabbat, the institute chair, and myself, we wrote an article in The Hill suggesting that actually Qatar should be designated as a state sponsor of terror, because we believe that its support for Hamas goes way beyond just hosting Hamas leaders for dialogue, but actually direct support, both propaganda, but also material support for Hamas in all different ways. And that if Qatar wanted to, they could shut down Hamas's financial network tomorrow. How do you see Qatar's relationship with Hamas? And to what degree is it, you know, in terms of truly providing support for terror organization? And to what degree is it, you know, only because they wanted to help the West create a platform for dialogue and negotiations?
First, it's interesting because when Qatar said, or Qatari officials said, we asked by the West to host Hamas, it's interesting to see the year they give an example. Most of the time, they're going to say 2012, because then the Hamas headquarters from Damascus. But their official spokesperson, Majid Ansari, for an example, and in other cases, even the prime minister, said it was 2006 under the Bush administration. And actually, the first appearance of Hamas officials in Doha was in 1999. And these discrepancies see at the fact that Qatar most of the time, sadly, Israel and the US sadly relied on Qatar, and this is bad calculation by the US and Israel. But as you mentioned, part of the funding wasn't just approval by Israel. And for the same way, we saw the fact that since Ahmad Yassin Day, we saw a support by Al Jazeera and other news outlets. Moreover, we need to remember that when Qatar received a carte blanche, for an example, when Qatari architects entered the Gaza Strip, I think 2017, if I'm not correct, then we need to believe that these were just for infrastructure or garbage disposal? I don't think so. And for that reason, we saw it right now. Under everybody focused on the Qatari participation in the Board of Peace. But we need to remember that Alpha Hura initiatives of education above all is operative in Qatar, in Gaza 2 years ago already. We saw, for an example, the Islamic University of Gaza, a Hamas stronghold, actually official from the board of directors of the Islamic University of Gaza, met with Qatari officials. And for that reason, Qatar will know how to use the cracks, how to use the carte blanche that give them to connect with Hamas. And more than that, just in the last Davos gathering, Prime Minister of Qatar says about the Houthis that they are a viable actor that we need to consider. And this is the Qatari way. The Taliban entered the room because Qatar said we need to talk with everybody. And the Houthis didn't enter the room because we need to talk with everybody. And the same way go to Hamas and Hezbollah. Because Qatar uses mediation to legitimize and whitelash terror movements under the false pretenses that they promised Trump that eventually business ties will reform it from the inside. But as we all know, it's a lie, and Qatar will know how to use this lie to expand its the terrorist operations.
So you touched a little bit on the Israeli concerns about Qatari influence in Gaza moving forward, and you know they're on President Trump's Board of Peace and his executive board for Gaza. In general, the Trump administration seems to trust Qatar quite a lot. But Israel is really, really resistant to Qatar being involved in Gaza. What do you think the concerns are and should be there moving forward?
I think that, as we mentioned before, the Qatari influence or the Qatari manner, let's say, or conduct, is less what we see on Netanyahu statements or Trump statements about Qatari soldiers in the Strip. First of all, it's not Qatari soldiers. It's probably going to be foreigners under Qatari pay. For right now, we saw that large parts of the Qatari army is actually relied on foreigners that Qatar paid them, for an example, from Bangladesh. And for that reason, the threat from Qatar is not soldiers. Maybe they'll do something in the minimum to give Trump, I contribute to your ISF that nobody wants to be part of it. But I think that Qatari threat need to be monitored very closely in the manners of in their operation in hospitals, in schools, in some legitimate movements. We saw cooperation, for an example, of Qatar Fund for Development with Ibrahim Al-Organi from Egypt. We saw actually that Qatar used its influence in Egypt to convince their status inside Gaza. And for that reason, I think we monitor close the things that before October 7th was after the fact. We saw Hamas try to find some Israeli bodies in approximate to Qatari hospitals. I think that this is the thing that need to be monitored, because it's not going to be a big one. It's going to be in the small allies. It's going to be in education. It's going to be in medicine. It's going to be under official and even legitimate purposes. And this is more challenging, but more dangerous.
Between 2017 to 2021, a number of the GCC and other Arab countries actually imposed a boycott on Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain. I think Yemen also was part of it. And then in 2021, under the auspices of President Trump and Jared Kushner, there was an agreement made. And then we saw last year, after Israel struck Hamas or tried to strike Hamas terrorists in Doha, we saw the sort of outpouring of sympathy and support for Qatar. But how do you think, really, if sort of, you know, beyond these sort of official proclamations, how do you think that the other GCC or other major Arab countries see Qatar today?
I think that this is why I'm not talking about the GCC in general, because actually right now the Saudi and the Emirates is even in more friction that it was, let's say, a year ago between Saudi and Qatar. I think that right now we need to take it case by case, because in Kuwait we see a cooperation, but normally we don't talk about Kuwait because it's less effective in our region. I think that the UAE still see, the official stance and try to respect Qatar, but try to influence maybe more, not directly. Try to counter-effect. For an example, we saw reports about the UAE desire to be more dominant in Gaza. I think it will confront with the Qatari position. I think in Saudi we see a changing, not just Qatar. We saw it, for an example, in terms of Yemen and Somaliland and Turkey. And for that reason, I think that in some manners they took a page from Qatari playbook, that no longer see terrorists as a problem, but see terrorists as, not, I don't say opportunity, but as a factor I need to count in, because they see in the UAE, it didn't work for them to be just pro-West. In the bottom line, you need to talk in their point of view, I think, the Saudi. We need to talk with everybody. And for that reason, I think that Qatar is pleased by this development. Actually, there was even a talk about Qatari-Saudi cooperation in Al Jazeera, about a joint TV program about the relation between Riyadh and Doha. And for that reason, when you see the GCC, I think it's interesting and troubling to see where Saudi will come next, if they will still be in more the Qatari camp or more the Emirati camp.
Bringing things back to Israel a little bit. In Israel, I think you talk about the Qatar, and these days people want to talk about Qatargate, right? Which is, of course, this whole story where they had hired some public relations professionals whose other client is Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister. What do you think Qatar was trying to accomplish in Israel by hiring these people? And how do you think that this domestic political scandal that we're having here with Qatar at the center of it, what kind of impact, if any, is that having back in Doha?
Lev, can I just add that you revealed in one of your articles that Qatar was also involved in an organization that was advising some of the hostage families at the outset, correct?
Yes. I'm blanking out on the name. It was started by Bill Richardson. It was a former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. that they help hostages around the world. And they have like the current head of the organization since Richardson passed away is Israeli. His name's I'm blanking out on the name, but he was advising the hostage families a little bit from the U.S. But they also, the organization gets a lot of money from Qatar. And then later revealed, sadly, I knew this, and then like hours before I was going to publish it, Politico published it, is Jay Futlick, who was a Democrat sort of power player in Washington, and also helped like Democratic politicians connect to the Jewish community. He also was a foreign agent of Qatar and advising hostage families on how to get their message across in Washington. And then a few months later, it turned out that this guy, Jay Futlick, was also the one who connected the Qataris to these communications experts, Yonatan Uric and Srulik Einhorn, who were working for Netanyahu.
Actually, it's interesting because Qatar tried to portray this as we gave something to Hamas with the mediation, but we gave also Israel help with the hostages. This is right the narrative they tried to push to see because they tried to claim to be an honest mediator and all these other make-up excuses. Anyway, when we try to examine Qatar Gate, first we need to remember it's not the original Qatar Gate is in the EU. It's sadly we borrowed, but this is why it's I think the Arab world wasn't surprised about transfer of money, because everybody knows that Qatar use its wealth in this kind of problematic conduct. I think actually this is why Qatar tried to not talk as they can about Qatar Gate, because it's just portrayed them as pro-Israelite. Because we are too much pro-Israeli, look, they are connected to the prime minister. Again, I don't say what, I don't gonna address specific name because it's highly political in Israel. I think we need to see how it's portrayed outside and what Qatar will do, because we actually saw when we tried to examine, as you mentioned, ask Lav, what they try to achieve, the goals that Qatar, according to what already published, was kind of not impressive. I mean, try to diminish Egypt importance, try to portray Qatar from the World Cup. There were reports in the Haaretz about how Qatar tried to build a synagogue and how in Jewish friendly environment. And I think the Qatar was actually, as Asher said before, working for the long run. How do you gonna exploit this connection, alleged connection again, right now? Sorry, I have contacts in both sides of the alley. Anyway, I think that how Qatar will use it in the long run is a way that Qatar don't want to push it, because they need more the influence operation, more they want to exploit it totally right now. And we need to admit, Netanyahu wasn't convenient for them. They actually, after the strike in Doha, Qatar focused its anger and they criticize mostly Netanyahu himself. And I think that this is why the question of Asher about the impact inside Israel. Right now, there is a suggestion by Lapid, the head of opposition in Israel, to designate Qatar as an enemy state. And it's actually kind of intriguing that in Israel, it's less talk about that it's talk about in Qatar. In Qatar, it's more important. There were statements by Qatar, by Israeli ministers that Israeli press didn't care for, but the Qatari press was very, very angry by it.
That's really fascinating.
Most of my articles in Ma'ariv, I didn't get too much responses, but I constantly see how Qatari friends translate it to Arabic. And it's amazing to see how it's important to Qatar, how they perceived in Israel. Why? For I think two main reasons. First, there is still thinking in Doha that if Israel is against us, eventually the U.S. will go along Israel. And it's a fear, maybe irrational, because I think under the Biden administration, even Trump, there was sometimes that Israel was more angered than Qatari than the outcome of the administration. But there is still fear that I need them to support me in a way. Second, Qatar know how to use its mediation, its influence in a way that promotes other interests. And they need Israel for intelligence, because the Washington Post already discovered about the fact there is some of cooperation in terms of intelligence, or for an example, a quick, let's say, military skills that maybe Qatar will try to rely in a way. And for that reason, they want Israel not just hating us. And for that reason, it was important to them. We saw it during the war, how the fact that newspapers and news desk was invited to Doha and enjoy the welcoming party, and how tolerant are the Qatari are. And for that reason, I think Qatar wants to return to the equation before the war, that we are allowed to attack Israel. Israel is more careful about us.
You've pointed out Qatar's sensitivity to criticism, which I think also is part of the reason why you've been very smart and invested not just on the Democratic side of the aisle, but also on the Republican side of the aisle. And then we know there are a number of people in the current Trump administration who received, received funds from Qatar, worked for Qatar, Qatari interests in the past. And they've also invested, I mean, not just Tucker Carlson, but in left-wing media and right-wing media in the United States and other areas as well. Our very first guest on Mideast Horizons, former U.S. National Security Advisor, Ambassador Robert O'Brien, suggested that he thought that Qatar, under the right conditions, could actually be brought into the Abraham Accords. Do you think that's a possibility, whether it's pressure, whether it's just sort of positive engagement, that Qatar, first and foremost for its own interests, could be brought to maybe change its approach and embrace? It's always kind of funny that they don't have relations with Israel, because they're talking to Israelis all the time. They're talking to Israeli journalists. They're Israeli business people who are known to go back and forth. They're hosting Israelis in Doha. Do you think it's possible that the Qatar could actually change course and perhaps join the Abraham Accords at some point?
Can I just interject here? I think the question has to be totally from Qatar's side, because I think on the Israeli side, they're so politically toxic at this point, and justifiably so. Yeah, there's good reasons that they're politically toxic. But it's also become a partisan political issue, you know, around Netanyahu. And I don't think that any Israeli leader would want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But in a different scenario where it wouldn't be toxic in Israel, I guess, the question would be, would Qatar be open to that?
Actually, there was a discussion, was in a radio show during the World Cup about Qatari normalization with Israel. I was one of the voices. There was a discussion between two, and I was the one that said it's not going to happen in a million years regarding Qatar. And I think the scenario didn't change, because for Qatar, it's more beneficial for them. And sadly, we saw it in Germany, in France, in US. It's more beneficial to rely on Qatar to talk with the terrorists. And for that reason, they get everything they can from Israel. According to some reports, there is an intelligence cooperation. There is a connection. We saw heads of intelligence agency in Israel visit Qatar, And for that reason, Qatar don't have a profit to gain from Israel. We saw it actually, Trump wants eager to expand Abraham Accords. And he actually, after the attack in Doha, said that looking forward to more cooperation between Israel and the Qataris. But when they talk about an optional names for Abraham Accords circle, Saudis were there, Kazakhstan was there, Qatar wasn't mentioned in any step. Because I think that Qatar approached Trump and said, we are going to be more helpful to you. We saw, for an example, the last U.S. ambassador to Qatar, Tim Davis, said it in April 2025. He said, Qatar is the default for us. When there is a conflict in the Middle East, we'll reach them first. Later on, he's get a cushy position in a Qatari firm. So, you know where the money came. But anyway, when he said so, on official capacity, Qatar tried and succeeded to convince many states, including Russia and Ukraine, don't ask from us to choose sides. Let us be the one that can close deal in your names, that can do the dirty work for you. And this kind of operation is sadly destructive, because Qatar know how to poison the process, as Elav mentioned before, during the negotiation about the hostages. We saw it. And for that reason, I don't think Qatar is an interest. As Lav mentioned, in Israel there isn't readiness, and I'm glad about that. I think I saw some analysts say that I contribute to that. I'm happy to take the credit. Anyway, I think that's more serious. There isn't a benefit for Qatar inside it. There isn't a readiness by Israel. And I think it's for the best, because I think that we need to take it to be far as we can from the Qataris.
All right, Dr. Ariel Edmoni, probably the top expert on Qatar and Israel. You really got a really good niche in your research that has made you an extremely valuable expert to many people since October 7th.
Actually, it's amazing. When I started my MA, people actually asked me a decade ago if I study a real country. It's amazing.
Some would argue that it's not a real country, so.
Yeah.
So they're right.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. This was very interesting.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Have a nice day.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org. And of course, we're on social media. You can send comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week.
See you next week.